talk about his brilliant but rather depressing book, All That Is Solid, The Great Housing Disaster. In a minute, he's going to check out his soul about the book. I'm going to ask him a few questions, and you'll have a chance to ask him questions, and then we'll sign up to the book as usual in the bookshop next door. Please welcome my guest, Mark Moore.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for coming, particularly to listen to what for many really is quite a depressing subject. I think that your view of housing may be very influenced by your age, because that will determine your experiences of the housing market or of renting privately, what you're used to and what happened to you. Often people of my age and older, when they hear about people complaining about housing, think, well, it was difficult for me too. We only just managed to get a house. We had to scrape by to do it. And it's just the same thing happening again. It's the same kind of moaning again. And I think one of the simplest ways of explaining why it's different, if you're older, and I think on average slightly over half the audience are older than me, and I do see some younger people, if you're of my age or older, when you were getting yourself housed and your family were getting themselves housed, particularly if you bought, and I suspect a majority of you in this audience will have bought a house, it was becoming easier, slightly easier, year after year. Slightly more people in the country as a whole and in Scotland were getting a mortgage and were getting on the housing market than the year before. So although it will have been a struggle for you, and it will have been hard, and you may have bought a house and not been able to furnish it for years and so on, it was not just possible, it was becoming more possible, so that if you waited a little bit, it actually got easier. And that is utterly and completely different to the situation today for young people, for people younger than me. Because since 1990... the proportion of the population who've been able to get a mortgage and been able to get onto the housing market has declined. In the 1990s, it declined very, very slowly, so we thought it had hit a plateau. But recently, that proportion has been going down rapidly. So it's not a case of people aren't saving and scrimping and so on, and it's like the past. It's much, much harder than it was, say, in the 1980s or 1970s to get onto the market, despite all the rationing in the 1970s. And you know that if you don't get on, it's going to be harder the year after. Hence some of the desperation of those people who manage to buy. Hence why in some parts of the country, house prices are so incredibly high. In the last 10 years in London, the proportion of families who are renting, in fact, in London and the whole of England, the portion of families who are renting has gone up from 1 in 10 families and children. This is renting privately, not renting from the state or a housing association. It's gone up from 1 in 10 to 1 in 4 families privately renting who have children. They're not choosing to do that. They simply do not have the option anymore to buy. And that is the context for people in Middle Britain, for the median family, of what's going on and why you get this kind of anger. I was thinking a week ago, what am I going to do to try to give you an idea about what I think is going on in the housing market, which doesn't involve slides. So I haven't got you any graphs, any numbers, any pictures. That's what I normally fall back on. I thought, let's have a go trying to do this without slides and statistics for once. There are quite a lot in the book if you're interested in those kind of things. So what I thought I'd do, and this was a week ago, is simply collect a newspaper story a day on housing to try to get a sense of what's now normal. So if you'll bear with me slightly, I'll just read this out. A week ago, the Observer headline was that house prices won't collapse yet, not with so many frustrated buyers waiting to buy houses. It is exactly the same headline as in the Observer today. How many of you buy the Observer, just out of interest? Right, fair number. Okay, you must know something. You really should complain. They really shouldn't be allowed to run the same story week after week, every Sunday on housing. And their story is, that the market isn't about to collapse. But the reason they can do it is because the news changes so much within 1 week and then comes back to the same thing again. The Guardian, I'm guessing quite a lot of you Observer readers are Guardian readers, The Guardian on Monday the 18th said record August slump in house prices. Average asking prices for new sellers in England and Wales was down 2.9% in July. London prices down 5.9%. That's massive. 5.9% drop is massive. But it's not a drop in prices. This is the asking prices of people putting their houses onto Rightmove. If more people put their homes and flats onto Rightmove, particularly flats, which are cheaper, the average asking price goes down. Doesn't mean that prices have got cheaper. The average price in London in June has got to 499,000. It's a whisker off that stamp duty threshold of 500,000 for the average London property. The Guardian reported on Monday that a housing commentator, Henry Pryor, said, "This looks and feels like the top of the market." Why? Because house prices had risen in the year to June by 10.2%, and in the year to May, they'd risen by 10.4%. So you had a 0.2% deceleration in the rate of growth. I know it's August, and they're desperate to fill up the newspapers, but that is not evidence of house prices yet going down. The Telegraph, just to show that I don't just read The Observer and The Guardian, The Telegraph on Wednesday decided to list all the falls that there normally are in August. This August, in the asking price, a 2.9% fall. In fact, we'd had 2.6, 2.3, 2.2, 2.4% falls in the last 7 or 8 years in August. Asking prices go down in August because people are trying to buy houses before September because they want to get their kids into that school that they're paying the money for the house for. It's the same thing again and again and again. By Thursday, I suddenly realised that I should read The Scotsman. So I quickly read The Scotsman. The headline in The Scotsman on Thursday, "Scottish house prices put homes out of reach. Edinburgh, Dundee, Aberdeen and Glasgow amongst the least affordable cities in the UK for second steppers." Scotland is blessed by tenements and by a sensible distribution of relatively small flats. But when you want to make that second step, particularly in Edinburgh, there's only one place in the UK where it costs more to do that, and that is London. Going from your tenement to your free bred house, on average in Edinburgh, is £180,000 extra. And that's way above many multiples of the average Edinburgh salary, which is £31,000. I'm guessing I've just got two more to go. The Yorkshire Post. This is yesterday. "It's cheaper to buy in Yorkshire than to rent a home because the cost of renting is so high." Buying isn't cheap. Interest rates are low, but prices are so very, very high that buying isn't cheap. Even at these historically low interest rates, you will still end up paying back to the bank or the building society roughly twice what you borrow. And that's an enormous sum. For somebody of my age or younger, that means paying back more than your parents on both sides of your family and your grandparents and everybody else who ever got involved in the housing market pay back in their entire lifetimes. That's the kind of debt you're taking. But the real reason for going through the papers, and I will speed up after this, was because I wanted to read you from Dominic Sandbrook and the Daily Mail. How many of you buy the Daily Mail? Oh, we really are at the Edinburgh Festival, aren't we? This is good. I had a very long train journey yesterday, it's my excuse, but I'm tempted to buy it again. Page 18 and 19 of yesterday's Daily Mail, "The Coming Apocalypse." So you don't get that in The Observer or The Guardian, do you? Right, "The Coming Apocalypse." Now, this is Dominic Sandbrook, who I tend to disagree with because I like the 1970s, and he seems to have a thing against them. But please just bear with me slightly. It's the last thing I'll read out about housing, and then I'll sum up my views, and then we'll have a debate. He's writing about ISIS and the Islamic State and so on, so it's fairly serious, but this is what he writes, and we'll get to the point about housing at the end. "Dawn on August the 23rd. And in the early morning haze, there are already queues outside Britain's petrol stations. Along the roads leading into major cities, the lines of cars snake for miles. Many drivers left while it was dark, hoping to beat the traffic through the anti-terrorism checkpoints. In central London, armed police are already on the streets, a familiar sight in these troubled times. At major train and tube stations, there are long delays as commuters wearily show their ID cards and wait beside full-body scanners. In Hyde Park, there are signs of last night's violence between the police and protesters in the vast peace camp, which has stood now for 7 years. A few early risers are brewing some mint tea. Always a sign. Guardian readers, mint tea. But most, of course, are still asleep. Scroungers, not strivers. At Britain's few remaining synagogues, are you serious? That's what's going to happen, according to Dominic. The mood is apprehensive. Although many rabbis have installed barbed wire to protect themselves from attack, they know they cannot let their vigilance slip. This is Britain 2030. Frightened, fractious and weary. And this is what Daily Mail readers get to read every day. Its economy sunk in the longest depression in history. Its people haunted by terrorism and war. The headlines never change. More bloodshed in the Middle East, more British families mourning their dead, more terrorist threats on Twitter, more protests out of the Palace of Westminster. These past few weeks, however, have been grimmer than ever. Earlier this month, unrest in one of the South Coast's sprawling refugee camps escalated into all-out fighting between security forces and Middle Eastern asylum seekers, with 13 people shot dead. So that's bad news. Ever since, thousands of demonstrators have blocked central London, even though roadblocks, major roadblocks such as Whitehall and the Mall and the Strand, have of course been sealed off by the military for almost a decade. For most ordinary families, meanwhile, the news is as bad as it has ever been. For the sixth consecutive year, the economy has shrunk and house prices have fallen. Now, that really was written by Dominic and appeared in the paper yesterday. And I think it illustrates how much... Now, I'm going to say this country, but when I say this country, I mean that country down there. How much that country believes that house prices are sacrosanct. They must go up, they must be maintained at all costs, and everything relies on this. And the greatest disaster you can imagine is not a world war, it's not mass terrorist bombs and so on, although that would be bad. It's a slight dent in housing prices. And in a sense, there is a sort of seriousness to this, because if you look at voting records in the past, particularly in the 1990s, when negative equity hit London, and especially the outer London suburbs, around about 94, 95, 96, there was an amazing map of London showing all the boroughs that the Conservative Party lost control of. The one thing Conservative voters will not forgive a Conservative government for is house price falls. They flock away. So it is a disaster from that side of politics. What needs to be done? Because I think you need a chance to talk back at me. We need to recognise just how bad and unusual this is, and it is not business as usual. The ability to house yourself well and to house your family is slipping away from the grasp of many people. We need to recognise that our housing is massively overvalued compared to the rest of the periphery of Europe, much of which actually saw values halve since 2008. We need to recognise that on average renters are working 2 days a week, now approaching 3 days a week, simply to pay their landlord's buy-to-let mortgage, and they're going to get angry about this. We need to recognise that we can't all secure our futures and our pensions by becoming landlords. It is not physically possible to do that. Only about 2% of the population of Britain are landlords, but about 25% of members of Parliament. And we need to recognise that most of the policies that George Osborne has produced and enacted in his budget since becoming Chancellor have been about propping up the housing market at least until the day after the general election. And that's where we are. We are in a crisis, heading towards a disaster. It's a disaster almost no matter what happens. It's a disaster if prices rise. It's a disaster for many people who've just bought if they collapse. A soft landing is no panacea. given that huge proportion of families with children who can no longer buy a house, because you need to be able to buy a house at a time when you want to stay still for 20 or 25 years in your life, and you do not want your children to have to lose their friends repeatedly. We do need to be a country for countries with more renting, more flexibility, but the way we're heading towards it at the moment is to become increasingly divided. Thank you very much.
I think I was listening to the Newsmax Centre, Jeremy Paxman, earlier today, who was talking about the aftermath of the First World War and how it changed everything. And one thing that the First World War changed was our view about housing. We did pose fit for heroes, the housing, council housing boom took off. Rents were controlled from the First World War onwards because housing began to be seen as a right, something that everybody had a right to have, rather than a form of speculative investment for house builders and renters. And all the way through from the First World War, when it became stronger through the 1970s and 80s, that idea that housing was simply a basic right and you should be able to house yourself, but you should not necessarily massively profit out of it, gained strength. And you saw homelessness legislation become more and more powerful. The most powerful came after Cathy Cummins' home and so on, in the early 80s. We then began to lose that. We began to lose that sense of this is something that people should simply be able to do. And we lost our scepticism, or we forgot about what it was like to have a group of people who were creaming off at the top, who are making a lot of money out of your absolute need to be housed. And so we've reached a point again where we're headed towards that pre-First World War housing situation of having mass private renting for the majority of the population. There are fights against this. I mean, one of the nicest examples that you can do something against this is Shelter Scotland. Shelter Scotland is tiny compared to Shelter England, but has achieved far more, including a change in the law in Scotland, so that letting agents cannot charge people all these dubious fees for becoming a private renter. To give you an idea of the difference between Scotland and England, I asked the Shadow Housing Minister, Emma Morsley, what ideas she might have to do anything of any use if she became Minister for Housing, and said, why not do what they've done in Scotland about making it illegal to do all these letting charges? The Scottish private rental market hasn't collapsed. And she said, oh, I think that's a bit too radical for us. This is the London Labour Party. That, I think, shows you how we've moved away from housing being seen as a vice to being seen as a legitimate part of the market for people to speculate in, when the Labour Party is frightened in London of intervening in that market.
And is it all Thatcher's fault, the right to buy?
I was actually in favour of the right to buy. The Big Bang in 86 and the creation of the Covered Housing Benefit Regime, that was Margaret Thatcher's government. So we pay out billions and billions to landlords now because of the housing benefits which are created in that. Right to buy, I think, was very good because my view about buying and renting is that we need to get to a situation where these two things are a real choice. You've actually got a choice between one or the other. At the moment, this is cheap to buy in somewhere like Oxford or Yorkshire, as the Yorkshire Post said, or much of Scotland, that it is cheaper to buy than it is to rent. These two things should be of a similar cost, and you should buy when you want to say absolute put for a long time. You should be able to say put for 3 years renting. But also, when you like doing DIY. Right? And some people do like doing DIY, they don't want the council door, they don't want the council wall, and they want to put something else up. And to be told you can't decorate and do that is awful. You should be able to do that. If you want to do that and have a responsibility to do that, like to buy. We don't want to do that, have landlords, and we should have a housing system in Britain where those who don't want to look after the property don't have to look after the property, and it's not about your future. So I'm fully in favour of Right to Buy. What I have in the book, which already exists in law, but only just, is we need an equivalent right to sell. And the right to sell, which already exists in Wales, Scotland and England, but not in Northern Ireland because the unionists stopped it. The right to sell is the right when you're about to be evicted from your house because you can't pay your mortgage, you can request that the council or a housing association buy your property and you become a landlord in it so you don't move.
Tent.
So you become a tenant in it and you don't move. The effects of that are massive. It already exists in Sheffield, for instance, several other families have taken up. Apart from the fact that it helps keep families in the same place and kids in the same school, it reduces the value of owner-occupied property where what's holding up the value is that it's a long way away from a council house. Because next door can become a council house if you have the right to sell. So we just need to mix the right to buy with the right to sell and we'll begin to move away from our current
problems. It's usually said that one solution to the housing crisis is to build more houses. You don't entirely agree with that?
No. I think maybe because I began writing a book when I was in Sheffield. When I turned up in Sheffield, which is 11 years ago now, they were blowing up lots of flats. Loads of blocks. I used to take my little boy, who was age 3, to see these flats being blown up until he started telling me that tower blocks were barren, and I realised I found the effect. But we had a lot. There was an enormous amount of property in the north of England and of Scotland. I mean, the only place that blew up more, you'll know it, the place that blew up more flats than something like Sheffield, of course, was Glasgow. I mean, 10 to 15% of his stock in about 10 years was blown up, I think, around about the 1990s. If we build huge numbers of houses across the southeast of England, we will be blowing up more flats and demolishing more loads of terraces in the north of England than in Scotland and in Wales. We currently have more houses and more rooms in our houses per head than we've ever had. But we're now sharing them out between the population worse than at any point, including 1911, which was an incredibly unequal year. Part of it isn't our fault. I mean, part of this is rising economic inequality. So more of us have second homes, third homes, who are under-occupying homes. Those right to buy council houses in London are increasingly occupied by a single professional, or two professionals without children. These all made available for families with kids. So we're using our housing stock less and less efficiently. But the other side of this is good news, which is we're ageing. And we never built a housing stock assuming we'd live to our 90s. It was very convenient when we died in our 70s. But in general, we have more housing than we've ever had. We don't need to build that much. There is one reason we need to build for. It's only one. It's really obvious. We need to build for the immigrants who are coming. That's the only reason to build. But we have an official policy that says there won't be any immigrants coming. Net zero immigration. We also have an official policy that says we're going to build 200,000 houses a year. And these two things don't gel. I would advocate some building in the South East, particularly in London, but around major towns, not in greenfields, otherwise there's a little bit more cars. But in general, we can sort out our housing problem by trying to be slightly more equitable with the distribution of what we've already got. And part of that will involve encouraging and not forcing elderly people who are in 4, 5, or 6 bedroom properties on their own, who often don't want to keep these properties, to downsize. That's the equivalent, if you can do it, of 40 years of rapid tax building. But it's very controversial. People get very worried that you're going to tax me out of my house. But we've never had more empty rooms than we have now.
But I mean, it's part of that you say that maybe people should move to other areas as well, right? Where there is cheap housing, there is other housing. So you're suggesting migration to the north or something.
I don't think we shouldn't have these areas becoming cheaper. We've had a huge imbalance since the crash. Since 2008, almost half of all new full-time jobs have been in London. Almost half in London. Most of the country has seen a decline in public sector jobs, apart from London. where the government's increased the number of public sector jobs. So there are more civil servants in London than there were in 2008. We need to move away from squeezing all the economy into London and the South East. Otherwise, we're going to have to do an over London and the South East at higher rates. And the more we squeeze everything into the South East, the more you'll see continued declines in Yorkshire and the North West and so on, and in parts of the South.
Going back to what you just said about the older person, therefore, like that, nice. Is that really feasible? Presumably, this is the person who's lived there for a long time, so their family grew up there, so his memories to do that property, they paid for it themselves, they worked hard in their lives. Should they have to move into a smaller place?
They shouldn't have to. Everything should be genuine choice. The way I put it, simply, young people shouldn't be forced into job training schemes, it should be a choice. So I believe in a market in many things. And these things do matter. I mean, my abiding memory of watching blocks of flats being blown up is people crying on the bridges because, of course, they grew up there. But if you're looking for what may be the biggest social problem in Britain at the moment, the biggest widespread social problem in Britain at the moment, it's loneliness. We've never had so many people who are so lonely who don't talk to anybody in the The second big problem is housing. You can see how you could begin to think, how can we match these two things together? Now, what is new, what is difficult, is we've had this very, very rapid aging, and we're not used to large numbers living to our 90s. And we're not used to a situation of watching people around us die, our first partner dying, maybe our partner for life dying, and having to rearrange who we live with. So this is going to be difficult. I think we need to start thinking about forms of housing as you get older. That mix you with other people for that long period of 20 or 30 years, it's the kind of housing that young people talk about, being a bit communal around the garden, sharing washing machines, whatever, which is silly, because they need to share washing machines with the last What is new is how many of us are living so long. And because of this, this is a new period. It's like teenagers being invented in the 1950s and 60s. It's a new demographic. And we need a new form of housing to cover that demographic, which will help people not rattle around spaces which are designed for families for children. That's apart from being a relatively cheap solution for those families with children who want to move in, it could also increase the happiness. But as long as it's done by choice, it should work. My one thing against choice is I wouldn't have people getting a discount on their council tax if they live alone in a live property. I know a lot of people depend on that, but there really is an incentive not to move. But the biggest incentive that elderly people have to stay on in a property they don't want to stay on in is that they're looking after the future interests of their children and grandchildren by trying to secure them the biggest possible cash gift at their death so that they, their children and their grandchildren, can themselves get a deposit to buy houses. And this makes sense individually for a family. It makes absolutely no sense for a country for people to be hanging on in large property they don't want to be in simply because they think it will help their children or grandchildren get a house themselves.
Because you believe that housing is a collective asset, if you say, rather than an individual asset.
Well, there are obvious limits, particularly in cities, where your use of this space actually reduces somebody else's ability to use the space. It's now reached a Bickerstaff in London, where members of the House of Lords, which is my favourite, the former peasants, their chauffeurs driving past row upon row of houses late at night with no lights on, because nobody's living in them. And they can't afford to live in them either. This is a problem. It's space. If we're talking about fine art, or good wine, or gold, you know, which parking a bit of electrical conversion, you know, isn't needed, I wouldn't be that bothered. But the problem with housing is that you're reducing somebody else's freedom when you take it up. You simply can't have a free market in housing with no regulation and end up with a well-housed population.
So what do you mean for the bedroom tax?
Well, the bedroom tax is massive. Because of who it's targeted at. So the most efficiently housed section of society are those in low-performing housing. They're the most tightly packed in. And the bedroom tax targets them first to try to get them more pumped in. And there aren't enough smaller properties for people to move to even if they're able to move. And it's nasty because one reason people need an extra bedroom, which isn't extra, is that they've got a relative, a son or daughter or brother, who screams at night because they've got a mental illness. Because they scream at night, their other child can't sleep in the same bedroom. You know, these are very, very common stories. So there's a nastiness. If we all lived in the density of people in social housing before the bedroom tax, we could invite in tens of millions of immigrants into fair housing, wouldn't we? Now, and I wouldn't fit the bedroom tax and have it as a general tax for the whole population. I think if, say you feel that for some reason it's really important to you to live in a six-bedroom house and as you and one other person want to do it, I wouldn't stop you doing it.
That'd be downsizing.
You tell me you lived in London. I wouldn't stop you doing it, but I would take council tax and I'd take the balance off so it went up and up and up. So it was a privilege. If it was really important that you do that, you could do that and you couldn't say come up to Edinburgh if it's be a choice. Because people definitely need to be living in these cities. And the degree of anger you get from younger people about this is quite startling. And what's unusual about it is it's from younger people who are not angry about almost anything else. They're younger people who've had a good education, whatever, done well. They've done well in the job market, they're relatively well paid. Everything else their life's going fine for them. They really are only angry about housing because there's no way they can possibly, on their own, get themselves housed. They rely on a gift from a relative. And we're moving back to that kind of time, of course, we talked about the kind of Jane Austen era, where if you're thinking about marrying, make sure you marry into the right family. And think about it. You know, do you want both sets of grandparents to chip in equally to the deposit? It would be a bit embarrassing if only one can. If you're going to university, go to the right university where you're likely to meet somebody from the right social class and provide housing equity to mean that you can do a job in London. Because doing a job in London won't depend on your degree. You're going to get a degree. It won't depend on you being skilled. Doing a job in London will depend on having granny and granddad who can lend you or give you £100,000 so you can buy a pokey flat in the Dalston Junction. And to get that, one of your best routes might be to marry into it. Well, I'm being a bit sceptical, but that's the direction in which we're heading. And we're heading back to family wealth mattering more and more. And those days in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, where it really was down to you, and hardly anybody had any money. If you wanted a deposit, you saved it up yourself and it was relatively small. And we borrowed money from these things called building societies, which had no shareholders, and were created to help people get the money to build a house. We're reversing away from that really rapidly.
So what about the help that the industry is giving to people to get their mortgages?
The help to buy. The help to buy is the most incredible scheme.
This is the scheme up here as well?
Yeah. And it we've been taken up here, particularly in poorer parts of Scotland. If it's anything like the pattern in England. When it was introduced, there were various kinds of help to buy. The first one was introduced to get people building homes together. The latest one was simply to pop up the market for the election on any home worth less than £600,000. Most of the take-up of the help to buy has been cheaper housing, particularly in poorer parts of the country. It's kept the house prices at zero rather than let them drop. We collectively are guaranteeing the first 20% of house price falls. The taxpayer is. If the policy carries on as it's doing, our total liability will be £120 billion. Right? Of taxpayers' money that doesn't exist, we're guaranteeing the banks that we will pay that first 20% of drops if they have to repossess the property. So the banks and the building societies, if you've got help to buy a mortgage, got quite an incentive to repossess you if you don't pay your mortgage for a month or two. Because even if they sell it at 90 or 85% of the price, they're going to get the full amount back that they've lent and all those payments you made. And this is what the policy is. It's to keep the housing market up until the next election. But they're not. To be fair to the Conservatives, Labour did this. In their last year of office, New Labour halved the amount of money they gave from regional aid. And they took the money they saved and they put it all into the mortgage rescue scheme in the south east of England to keep the housing market in the south east up. And the only reason I know this is completely true is I got a phone call one day inviting me to 11 Downing Street to meet a bloke called Corby and the little team that advised when it was Gordon Brown and then it was Hannister. And they took me down to the canteen under 11 Downing Street and said, "Have you noticed what we've done?" And I said, "No." And they said, "No, nobody's noticed what we've done. We think we've got away with it." But you've got to think back to then. This is 2009. There was absolute fear that we would get what has happened in Greece, or in Spain, or in Portugal, or in Ireland, or in Iceland, or in every single other country that distance from Berlin had seen a housing market crash. But unlike all those other countries, we have 60 to 65% of our entire wealth tied up in housing. So the idea that in particular the South East market can crash is simply not around across the political spectrum. You can have a permitting in Scotland, to be honest. And the Scottish market's always gone out to sink in London by a long way. Westminster would be fine, I think, with housing prices halving up here. In fact, it would make it easier to buy your holiday home. But the south east of England is absolutely sacrosanct. That cannot be allowed to bear across the spectrum. But it's particularly important, of course, to Conservatives, because that's where their core support is. Why vote Conservative if the party you vote for allows your wealth? The wealth you're sure is yours, and you've got, if somebody's going to buy your house at this incredibly inflated price in the future, why vote for them if they allow that to slip away?
I think it's similarly voted come for a yes vote there.
I was trying to take myself off while talking about this. I mean, I'll say one thing on yes. I'm amazed, I mean, you'll have been, you're probably sick of it right now. But in England, there really is very, very, very little coverage. I wrote one thing in a paper about just how little coverage there is. And I celebrated the one non-Scottish academic who did something on the debates. And I sent it to him just before I published it. He said, "Actually, I'm Scottish." And it shows. I mean, it's incredible. England takes it absolutely for granted that there will be a no vote, and there's no chance of there not being a no vote. So there is no discussion in England whatsoever, and they could be right, there's no discussion whatsoever of what the aftermath to a yes vote would mean for England.
Unless you avoid pushing that. Yes. So go down that route. You talked very interestingly about what's happening in Ireland and also in Europe in terms of land tax.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about it?
Yes.
That works and you can see it working here.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Ireland's been forced to bring in a land tax. So since January, Ireland's had a land tax. It's pretty small, it's something like 0.018% of the value of your property a year. It's progressive. If your property's worth more than €1 million, it's a higher rate. They have it because the Germans insisted that they have it, because the Germans would like their money back at some time. It is universally unpopular in Ireland, and they bought it in within a year, and they have no land registry. Now in Britain, we're told that it will take years and years and years to complete the land registry, particularly up here, with the families who own much of the land in Scotland who don't want people to know they own that land. And the mechanics of introducing the land value tax would just be too hard to do. So Ireland showed it's entirely possible. Ireland's also shown the circumstances in which you get a land value tax, and that is economic disaster. And which brings me back to there are numerous ways in which something could go wrong again, like 2008. But in the event of them going wrong, this country, these countries, with its tiny little currency, which for some strange reason we seem to think is safe now, you know, sterling, backed up by not very much, would have to raise money somehow. And only fast way to face it will be allowed down in tax and send it islands. Because last time we raised money was by the most draconian cuts in the whole of Europe. You just can't cut any more than that.
You did talk about some benefits, for example, that people will be less willing to keep houses empty
But there's almost universal support amongst academics and economists, who, I tend to be on one side away from economists, the economists tend to be the other side. There's almost universal support for the logic of a land value tax. It's the political reality of trying to impose such an emotive tax on people that means we can't even increase the council tax ban. Only Wales has put in one extra council tax ban, that's it. I've yet to meet anybody opposed to land value tax on ideological grounds, except people against all taxes. And I've met a lot of people who like to reduce income tax to make jobs more worthwhile and increase things like land value tax. Winston Churchill was part of the land value tax campaign. It's an odd critics. I honestly think it would only come in an emergency. And the man who could bring it in more than anybody else would be George Osborne. Because who would get there be for the life of him to tell him what to do? Well, George is currently paying it, or his family are, because they're a major landholder in Ireland. So it's not that he likes the idea. But we would get one in the event of an economic crisis. And we should at least learn since 2008 that an economic crisis is possible again. And we don't talk about loans on sterling. And I think we should think about, what happens if you get a loan on the currency? You have to increase interest rates. What happens if you increase interest rates in this country? How many hundreds of thousands of people would fail to pay their mortgage payments within 6 weeks? So what happens if you get a loan on sterling? What did George Soros do last time he saw an opportunity like this? Yeah, the British government will do everything it can to chuck in money to try to avoid a loan on sterling. So you go in and you make a bomb like George Soros did last time, because you can hold the country for ransom. I just think those kind of things, we should at least consider the possibility that we've put ourselves in a situation where we're extremely vulnerable. Now, as it is, we're having some stupid argument about whether the Scots would be allowed to have this crappy little country anyway. rather than how economically unsafe Scotland might be. Without looking at England,
brought Scotland, back again.
The English debt is as big as a Greek debt, and it's massive. This is all put on the list. Don't worry, your house price is safe. Your home, that little three bed, slightly boxy semi, in the larger and smoothest part of London, honestly is worth £600,000. Who's going to buy it? Who is going to buy it? Who's going to have the money? You've already seen that we can't sell the student loan book because there are not financiers stupid enough to think that university graduates, which includes half of young women in England, are somehow going to become incredibly rich in the future and be able to pay their loans back. That's already been realised. It wasn't just the table letting it out of the bag. These university graduates are the bulk of your first-time buyers in 10 years' time. We know they can't pay their loan back, so they're going to buy your £600,000 property? It doesn't work. We can have more immigration of very rich people in the world, but there aren't actually that many very rich people in the world, and most of them only want one flat in London. And then why have 10 empty flats in London? There's a limit. Part of the reason for the current boom in London is that the Americans have forced the Swiss banks to open up their accounts so America can see who's got money in Switzerland. So what do? You take your money out of Switzerland and you buy something in London because the Americans can't see you've got it. But that's a time-limited thing. There are many, many scenarios about things going wrong. The scenario about things going right requires an incredible amount of faith in everything lining up just perfectly. The economy booming brilliantly, our banks going back up to being the strongest on the planet. Nothing must go wrong for our housing to end up being worth as much as we think it is worth.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you for depressing me even more than you started. Thank you for your patience with me. Let's get some questions from the audience. If you'll keep your questions succinct, please, then that can be better. So this lady here, and Mark, try and get her in short.
Not all major European countries have got such a high proportion of owner-occupied as the UK's had, or aspirations, as far as I know, in that direction. What are your views about that, and would that be a scenario for us in the long-term future?
I don't think we should be entirely depressed about private banking having business so rapidly. Our private banking is still too low for the kind of mobility we need. What we never predicted was that the big buyers would be people with kids because they can't afford to buy. So we need to do what Germany does, which is give tenants rights so that they can stay in for 2 or 3 or 4 years. The rent cannot be put up when they're there. And if the landlord wants to get them out, the landlord in Germany has to buy them out of property. And that works perfectly fine for Germany, works pretty well in Switzerland. So we should look at it. And in the Netherlands, they've got a very good market as well. We need to look at that. The problem is that young people and tenants do not vote or even register to vote. So the political parties do not see a huge benefit in promising these things for the young. If the young's parents could, if it was possible to have a little bit of empathy and think, what's going to happen to my kids? Would it be good if my kids' landlords had to behave better? Because the parents do vote. I think there could be some scope. And it's requiring that we need the generation who vote and who are looked to think one step away from themselves. And rather than thinking, I'm a form of personal insurance for my family, because there's limited how much you could do that, think I would like a government which meant that my children could rent and could afford to rent and were not somebody who put in a situation where they have to either pay more rent or do. And we could also get the quality of renting in these other countries. People from the rest of Europe are shocked by how shoddy our rented property is. Things like the damp and the sand proofing. And you don't get good quality without a good market. And you don't get a good market without freedom to choose. And you don't get freedom to choose without rent being low enough that you can pick and choose between properties.
Are you saying that property crash would be something salutary, at least in the southeast? And if not, are you saying maybe soft landing crash? But if it's a soft landing, what form would it have?
Okay. A property crash would have victims, and then would be a bit of a mess. I could create a bigger crash, a confidence in our whole banking system, which in the long run might not be a bad thing, but in the short and medium term would be very painful. Grant Shapps, when he was housing minister, Grant Shapps said that property prices should go up 2% less than wages. And that's what I'd like. So, because wages are only going up 1% at the moment, that means a 1% drop every year in property prices. We need to get our property back to what it's actually worth, which is at least a 30% reduction in what we currently say. Danny Blanchflower said this years ago. If you just look at it, just look at a house or a tenement and think of the cost of building it, paying the rookies and the material and so on. It is much less. I've looked at property in the heart of London where even if you were to paint it with a relatively thin layer of gold on every surface, 3-bed property in Mayfair would still not be worth £20 million. So at some point this is likely to happen. Unless this country becomes more of the international tax haven for the world and we have a kind of Singapore in the future. But we need a recognition that it may happen so people are not fine thinking the property's going to rise in value in the future. 1% down a year will soon be fine for 30 years. And it would be. It will be in my interest because I have 3 children. If I had 1 child, not if I had no children, of course not. And we're, again, this relates to Piketty. We're heading back into that kind of time.
One of the other changes in the last decade has been a dramatic decline in the supply of social housing. And I wonder if you could just comment on the that, the effects of that on the problems that you described, but also the benefits and the prospects for a revival in the role of straight bus and train in this country.
Yeah. It's the decline and lack of council house building has helped all these kind of prices are so high. My view of that differs from many people on the left in that I'm not in favour of building new council estates. I think there was a massively successful policy of the past. I'm in favour of the state owning homes that are pepper potted all over the place and buying at the bottom of the market. And of a whole raft of people being helped and allowed to build houses, not at a profit. So all kinds of people definitely want to build homes. And I'd be more in favour of that. But. So I'm against councils building estates, partly because it creates these ghetto areas. Whereas I think if we can break up the monolithic home-occupied ghettos, that would help steady things. It would help, you know, housing around here, which, and in Newtown, what is it holding up the house price there? It's the idea that the houses will carry on being worth that much in the future, and who the neighbours are. But if you no longer know who the neighbours are, you know, you can see that you've steadily moved towards something more normal. And the reason for wanting that is that at the moment, and for the last 40 years, it's been sensible to stretch yourself as much as possible to buy a tenement or a house in the poshest part of town as possible, because that part of town will see the biggest increase in prices. And we need something to get us away from housing being a good, but unlike every other good, there's an incentive to try to spend as much as you can on it. And it's mainly about location, that's mainly about prejudice and social segregation.
If we think about the drivers of house price inflation, is there anything that you see as being more important in driving house prices than the availability of mortgage credit, which itself is built on fractional reserve banking?
Increasing numbers of people are buying houses without mortgages. This includes, well, not the majority, but increasing numbers. Occasionally, a Conservative minister will let it slip. When they need this language about mortgages, they actually talk about people beneath them. Because in their family, you don't use a mortgage. When you're talking about people investing, often they've got money and they buy. In London, at least a third of the property is being talked about a mortgage. Partly overseas buyers, but also very rich people. And as our income inequality has been going up for 40 years. So as the gap between your incomes rises and rises, you end up with a lag to increase in wealth inequality. So we're kind of not aware of a small group of families who have a lot of wealth. So even if you were to choke off the availability of mortgages, that doesn't necessarily mean a reduction in house prices, particularly in the most salubrious parts of, say, Edinburgh or London, or Salcombe, all those other nice little, you know, bays on the coast that you buy holiday homes.
Okay, so mortgages are just one mechanism to transfer credit from fractional reserve banking into income, right? So if you focus on the second rather than just the first part.
Yeah.
Yeah, I take.
Okay. But the idea we're supposed to have had at the beginnings of a slight mortgage rationing. As yet it's shown no effect. It's a bit like student fees. When student fees came in down there, okay? This is quite incredible. I no longer teach for the students. I used to teach lots of them. When they came in at 1,000, we thought that the students would drop. When they came in at 3 before they dropped, they actually go up. At 9,000, they've gone up even more. Because young people have no other option if they can to try to get a degree. Housing and mortgages are similar. So you can ration, you can increase interest rates. People desperately try to get themselves a house. Because in London, the average renter is being moved on once a year. And you don't want that.
I want to return to your point, which I think is really very important about loneliness and isolation of older people. I mean, current research says that the impact of loneliness and isolation of older people is equivalent to 15 cigarettes a day. And clarity that the current models of health and social care, just like housing, don't work for frail elderly people with complex needs. Have you thought about joining up your policy thinking with people from health and social care?
It's only recently I've just began to look at the connections between these things. And the problem is people are very worried about being coerced and forced to do something. Although it's interesting, because the young are being coerced and forced to do things that they definitely don't want to do. The elderly seem more aware of their rights and hygiene. Half the problems are too much. We used to smoke more. When you filmed me, did smoke more, that's what we didn't. But these things do be sorted, but they're much more complex than just housing. 10 years ago, ONS did a brilliant, the Office of National Statistics had a big national survey, included a whole series of questions to the over 65s about how you would feel about making new friends with somebody again and finding a new life partner later on in life if you're when your first one died. And we're going to have to look at these kind of things quite a lot. Because we've had one generation who will only sick with one for life, and the women, it's almost always the women just coming on their own. We've got the 60th generation coming through retirement now, and if they can behave a bit differently in retirement as they behave differently when they're younger, that could be fairly efficient for housing. And this is in direct interest. It is, if you're trying to get me to think selfishly about myself, the most likely future for me, if I don't have the heart attack because I fail to eat less or succumb because I do like cigarettes, the most likely future for me in 40 years' time is that my children will come and visit me occasionally, but more as a duty than wanting to. And it can be pretty miserable. We saw deaths in the elderly rise in the last 2 years. There's a 5% rise in deaths of the over 85 women. And I can't help thinking it was connected to a big decrease in trips and visits. As the price of petrol went up, what's the first thing you don't do when the price of petrol rises? You don't visit great aunt to so-and-so. Because you never really... it's all a bit horrible. And we need to begin to sort this out in our direct personal interest. And it goes back to Bevin and what the elderly want to create of perambulators, and they want mix, and what the people with perambulators want, they want somewhere their baby can sleep.
It's also engaging communities.
And caring for each other, not relying on the NHS to care for us. And at the bottom of all this, and I go on about our debt because we are becoming poorer. We have been becoming poorer for a long time than when we were empire. We are becoming poorer now. When we're dealing with becoming poorer as a country, would be caring for each other more and not making everything a market transaction. And we have enough housing to fit into the way we're progressing together. But we are so far away from thinking along these lines. At the moment, our thinking is, look after yourself and your family. There is no shifts in this society. Anybody who says otherwise is naive.
I'm just going to squeeze the final question, because I'm sorry, sir, that I'm not going to be able to get you a queue after all.
I'm an ex-family researcher, I'm very much in plenty of time. Two comments, really. One is around the comparison of only mounting. I'm wondering whether people here are aware, because it's only just brought to my attention, that nowadays when young people take on mortgages, they tend to be over 30 years, not 25 years. So actually the comparisons are kind of probably not what was the case when we first bought, when 25 years was the usual term on a mortgage. I can't believe that that's the kind of length of debt that we have to take on in order to make the current payments look like less than the rent that I was previously paying. The other thing is, I'm really interested in the private rented sector as well. I think probably a different kind of private rented sector to the traditional way of thinking about it. Again, I'm out of date, but I think there's a link here. The link for me is with pensions. And the reason that many of us hang on to our homes is because they're our pensions. So can we not have some kind of investment vehicle? I'm sure you'd be about that, so that we can put our money into a kind of German model for the rental sector.
Okay. On the last one, there have been suggestions of ways to do that. we have to realise that our pensions will rely on young people being well catered for. We are not going to be happy pensioners if the generation beneath us